The flood is one of the most well-known stories in all of the Bible. As a matter of fact, you don't even have to have attended Sunday school to know about Noah and the ark. Everybody has heard about Noah. They might not know about some of the other people in the Bible, but they know about Noah. Now, as you know, that story is in the book of Genesis. And while it's a fascinating story to those of us who trust the scriptures, that story causes some problems because people that, you know, decide they want to find out what the Bible is about start reading the Bible. And the first thing they encounter is in Genesis chapter 5, there's this long list of names they can't even pronounce. And if they make it through that long list of names, the next thing that happens is they're plunged into the story of the flood in chapter 6, and it goes all the way through chapter 9. And that has caused a lot of people problems with the Bible. I've had them say to me, I couldn't make it past that list of names, or I couldn't make it past the flood. Do you mean to tell me that there was a flood that covered the highest mountain? That's what that book says. You mean that actually happened? And they have problems at that point and throughout the rest of the Bible. So, in this series on the question, is the Bible historically accurate? Let's talk about the flood. Did it actually happen as described in the book of Genesis? And here is the issue. Is there any evidence for that outside the Bible? Now, if you believe the Bible, you automatically accept that because you believe in the miraculous. But if you don't believe the Bible, is there any evidence outside the Bible that these stories are true? Well, let's look at the flood. I'm really going to do two things. The first is, I want to talk about the flood itself. Where did the water come from? Where did it go? Things like that. And the second thing I want to do is talk about the ark. The ark is a huge problem for people. Could it hold all the animals? Where'd they put all that food? Etc., etc. So those are the two aspects of the flood we need to talk about. But for starters, we need to just see what the Genesis record says. Now, I've got a lot of material to cover, so having you turn to all these passages could be very time-consuming. So I'm just going to refer to them. Let me just say that Genesis describes the flood by saying, quote, it covered, quote, all the high hills under the whole heaven. That's Genesis 7:19. It says, and the mountains, Genesis 7, verse 20. The idea of a flood covering the whole earth sounds unusual, and to many people it sounds unlikely, but that is exactly what the scripture is saying. Matter of fact, some Christians, embarrassed by this, thinking they can't defend it, actually say, well, it was a local flood, not a universal flood. But those verses indicate that it was a universal flood. Now, if it's universal, that just raises all kinds of questions. Pertaining to the flood itself, the question is, where did that water come from? Where did that water go? And is there any evidence outside the Bible that there was that much water on this planet at one time? Well, let me take these questions one by one. Genesis says, quote, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened, and the rain was on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. That's Genesis chapter 7, verses 11 through 12. Now, if you listen to those verses carefully, you will note that it's telling us where the water came from. It's telling us that the water came from the deep That's from under the earth. And, to use the expression in Genesis 7, the windows of heaven. So there were two sources of water. One came from heaven, rain, and the other came from the deep. Now, those need some explanation. So let me explain. I'm first going to talk about the water that came as a window from heaven. According to Genesis 1, when God originally created the earth, there was a canopy of water covering the whole earth. If you read Genesis 1 carefully, it says he divided the waters. So there was water in the heaven called the firmament and water on the earth, and the space in between was the sky. So apparently, before the flood, there was this huge canopy of water that surrounded the entire earth. What the Bible is teaching is that canopy of water fell on the earth. That's one of two sources of the water. One author has said, the windows of heaven were opened is a figure expressing the torrential downpour that fell from heaven. The ocean of water above the earth mentioned in Genesis 1 fell to the earth. It is possible that there was enough water above the earth in that canopy of water to cover the face of the earth. So, one source was that canopy of water before the flood that didn't exist after the flood. Another has said, the Bible is not alone in saying there was a large amount of water above the earth before the flood. There are widespread accounts of an ancient water heaven. That author says, and this time I quote, if there were a water heaven that condensed and resulted in a global deluge, we would expect to find a universal flood and water heaven traditions. And this is exactly what we find. End of quote. So there is reference in the Bible and some traditions outside the Bible that there was this waterly canopy around the earth. The second source of water was from beneath the earth. The water of the flood didn't just come from above, it came from below. Genesis says in Genesis 7:11, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up. The Hebrew word translated deep is used of subterranean waters in Genesis 49:25 and Deuteronomy 33:13. It has been suggested that the expression, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up, refers to a great volcanic explosion that erupted, resulting in the whole surface of the earth being changed during the flood. Interesting. There's no hint of that in Genesis. It's just been a suggestion. If the seabeds arose and the continents sank, I got to use a little imagination for a minute. The idea is if all the deep rose and the continents sank, it would push all this water up, right? All right. It alone would cover the earth. In fact, if the oceans were filled with material such as produced by a volcanic activity, to a mean depth, that is an average depth, and the land were pushed down on an average level, water would cover the entire earth to a depth of a mile and a half high. Did that make sense? If you just could take the bottom of the ocean and push it up, and the land and push it down to their average depth and their average height, there would be enough water coming out of the ocean to cover the earth to the height of a mile and a half. Who figures out these things? Some engineer. All right, at any rate, the water for the flood came from a large body of water above the earth and the water from under the earth. All right, that's one question. Where did it come from? Second question, where did it go? Well, Genesis says that after the flood, quote, God made a wind to pass over the earth and the waters subsided, Genesis 8:1. The waters receded, Genesis 8:3. They decreased continually, 8:5. They dried up from the earth, 8:13. These verses describe the water evaporating into the atmosphere and receding back into the earth. So, they evaporated, went back. Now we have rain and clouds, and went back under the earth. Perhaps God caused the ocean floor to sink, drawing the water off the land masses. I want to read a psalm, a portion of a psalm. Psalm 104, 6 through 8 says this, "The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke they fled. At the voice of your thunder they hastened away. They went up over the mountains. They were down into the valleys, to the places which you founded for them." Now, that's Psalm 104, part of it. That passage is usually taken to be a reference to the creation. However, some claim that it is an apt description of the flood, and that verse 8 should be translated, "The mountains rose and the valleys sank." Now, whether or not that's true, I don't know, but it sure is an interesting theory. Why couldn't God play with the surface of the earth, meaning the bottom of the oceans and the land masses, and shift them so the water could cover the face of the earth and then go back to where it is now? All right. Now the question is there any evidence of a universal flood outside the Bible? And the answer is an emphatic yes. And it comes from two sources. One is geology, and the other is literature written from all over the earth. Let me start with geology. The very presence of a fossil suggests the forcefulness of a catastrophe. If an animal dies and its carcass lies on the ground, it simply deteriorates until it disintegrates and disappears. The only way a fossil can be formed is by some kind of a catastrophe whereby the animal suddenly dies and is preserved. Interesting. There has to be sudden pressure to produce that fossil, I am told. Whitcomb and Morris, one a theologian, the other a scientist, wrote a book called The Genesis Flood, and in it they explain preservation of organic material by whatever means requires some sort of catastrophic condition, some kind of a quick burial by engulfing sediments, usually followed by some abnormal chemical means of rapid solid, creating a rapid solid. So, the very presence of a fossil indicates something like the flood happened. Virtually the entire earth is covered with fossil graveyards containing fossils of thousands of plants, animals, fish, and birds. They are found on mountains, including the Rockies, the Himalayas, and the Alps. in the plains, in Paris, in prairies, in the desert, and even in the Sahara Desert. Perhaps a local flood could explain some of these cases, but there are many of them scattered all over the whole earth, including the tops of mountains. A universal flood is the most logical explanation of such fossil graveyards. For example, take the mammoth fossil in the frozen tundra of northern Siberia. The mammal is a much larger member of the elephant family. The tusk of a modern African elephant weighs from 40 to 50 pounds. The tusk of a mammoth weighs from 180 to 200 pounds. Remains of these extinct animals have been found in various locations all over the world. They have been found in great abundance in Sahara. Mammoth carcasses found in Sahara were in a standing upright position in the ground as they had sunk down and had been frozen in that position. Their long hair was intact. Food was found in their mouth and stomach was not of the kind that was from that region. They perished suddenly in some great catastrophe. You ever heard that? Is this the first time you've heard that? You heard this before? Yeah. Several of you have? I remember hearing this many years ago for the first time thinking, how do you explain that? I mean, if there's a mammoth and it's got all its hair and food in its mouth and food in its stomach frozen top of some mountain, how did it get there and how did it get preserved in that state? Flood explains it. That's the most logical explanation. As if all that is not amazing enough, the number found are astonishing. Since about 900 AD, men have been selling these ivory tusks in Arabia, China, and Europe. In a 20-year period in the 19th century, at least 20,000 mammoths were taken from one Siberian mine. They mining these animals. So there's lots of them, not just one. Commenting on the Siberian mammoth beds, Whitcomb and Morris write, quote, "It is transparently obvious that the catastrophism of a very high order is alone sufficient to account for such things as these," end of quote. There is more evidence for a universal flood. Two distinguished geophysicists claim that they have discovered evidence for a flood 7,500 years ago in the Black Sea. Their names are Rand and Pittman. They wrote a book, Noah's Flood, the new scientific discovery about the event that changed the world. So there, I have not explored that line of evidence, but the fossil record that I've just talked about, I think, indicates there was a universal flood. Now, that's fascinating to me. But there's some other evidence of a universal flood, and it is the ancient literature. Now, I'm going to run through this. There's tons of this. If you don't believe in a universal flood, I want you to explain this to me, all right? This is really compelling to me. There are worldwide traditions of a worldwide flood. Some of the accounts date so far back as the early second millennium B.C. Some of what I'm about to tell you dates back to 2,000 years before Christ. Now, to put this in perspective, Moses wrote the Pentateuch around 1500 BC. So 500 years before Moses wrote Genesis, some of these stories crop up. And this is most fascinating. Hundreds of traditions of a universal flood have been found in every part of the world, including both Eastern and Western hemispheres, traditions from Europe, Asia, Australia, the East Indies, Polynesia, South America, Central America, North America, and East Africa. The traditions of a universal flood vary in details, but common in most is a flood that covers the earth and destroys all but a few humans. Many include the story of an ark and that finally rested on a mountain. So we take, and there's all kinds of these from all over the earth. And they differ in detail. There are details that differ, but they all talk about a universal flood with a boat and just a handful of people who survive. Now, in an Egyptian legend reported by Plato, only one man was saved from the flood. There are similar traditions in Asia Minor. There was an ark on some of the coins found in that region. And from Greece, according to a legend from India, a man and seven others were saved in a ship from a worldwide flood. In a Chinese version, a man and his wife and their three sons and three daughters were spared. That's China. I get carried away. There is another survivor among, there's a story about a fellow who survived in the Hawaiian Islands. And there's one in the among the Mexican Indians. No less an archaeologist than the famous Albright said that the biblical account and the Babylonian accounts of the flood were, quote, remarkably close parallels, end of quote. One author explains the similarities. This is the Babylonian account, an ancient Babylonian account of the flood. He says, in the Babylonian account of the deluge, every major premise of the Mosaic record is sustained in its entirety. One account tells of the heavenly warning. It depicts the gathering of material and the building of an ark. In the ark was safely carried the hero, his wife, and his family, and certain beasts of the earth for seed. The ark was made watertight, exactly as the ark in Noah is recorded in the book of Genesis. Entering the ark, the Babylonian account tells how the boat came under the direct supervision of the gods. On the same night, the mighty torrent of water fell out of the sky. The cloudburst continued for 6 days and nights until the tops of the mountains were covered. The sea arose out of its banks and helped to overflow the land. After the seventh day, the storm abated and the sea decreased. By that time, however, the whole human race had been destroyed, with the exception of the little company that was in the Babylonian ark. The ark of Babylon, grounded in that position of the ancient world known, was known as Armenia, the Hebrew name of which comes Ararat. 7 days after the landing of the ark, the imprisoned remnant sent forth a dove. When she found no place to light and rest, the dove returned to the ship. They waited for a short while and then sent forth a sparrow. The sparrow also returned, wearied from a long flight, and several more days were allowed to elapse. The next attempt to discover the condition of the earth by the imprisoned remnant resulted in the sending forth of a raven. The bird returned and approached the ark, but refused to return to the ship. The remnant knew then that the flood had ended. They accordingly went forth with all of the redeemed life and celebrated the preservation by offering a sacrifice to the gods upon the mountains. The goddess Ishtar was so pleased with the sacrifice of the godly remnant that she hung in heaven a great bow which the father of the gods had made for the occasion. She swore by the sacred ornament that hung around her neck that mankind would not again be destroyed by the flood, and the heavenly bow was the sign of that covenant. The incidental details which are found in this manuscript coincide too closely to the record of Genesis to be a coincidence. Is that incredible? Did you hear that? Wow. Outside of the Bible, there is evidence for a universal flood from geology and from literature. All right. The other issue that comes up is the ark. I've discussed the flood, where the water came from, where it went, and the extra biblical evidence that it happened. But the big issue is also the ark. Could the ark hold all the species of animals? All right, let's explore that. According to Genesis 6:15, the ark was 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide, and 30 cubits high. It had three decks, Genesis 6:16. A cubit was basically the length of the arm from the elbow to the middle, to the top of the middle finger, the end of the middle finger. There were several cubits that were standard, and there are references to this in the Bible. One was a hand breadth longer, and one was about 18 inches and the other 24 inches. In other words, the way they measured it was from the bottom of the elbow to the top of the middle finger, and this was considered to be 18 inches. And then some had another measurement. They put a hand's width on top of the middle finger, and that whole distance was roughly 24 inches. That's the way they measured things. Now, we do not know for certain which cubit, this measurement, was used. Was it the 18-inch cubit, or was it the 24-inch cubit? So let's just talk about both possibilities. Assuming a 24-inch cubit, the ark was 600 feet long. The Queen Mary is 1,018 feet long, 100 feet wide, and 60 feet deep. If Genesis is referring to an 18-inch cubit, the ark was 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 40 feet high, which is analogous to a four-story building. Many have concluded that it was in the shape of a barge and not a ship. In 1609 through 1621, a Dutchman built a vessel the size of the ark to satisfy himself concerning its seaworthiness and its storage capacity. Henry Morris, a former professor of hydraulic engineering at Virginia Polytechnical Institute, said that the proportions of the ark in length, breadth, and depth have been proven to be hydraulically dynamically sound. All of which is to say that if we took these measurements and actually built this thing again, it'd float. That's all they're saying. All right. Assuming a cubit of 17 and a half inches, the ark had the capacity of... You almost have to be mathematically inclined to listen to this. 522 standard rail car, stock rail cars, or 8 freight trains of 65 cars each. Now, did you get all that? No. Well, hang with me for a minute. Based on the size of the ark and the number of species of animals, 17,600, there would have been room for two of each species, 35,000. especially if only the young were aboard, and even more room for the flood. So Noah and his family, in fact, could have taken two trains handling 73 cars each. Now remember what the total capacity was? It was 522 cars, or 8 freight trains of 65 cars each. Let's stick with that. 8 freight trains of 65 cars. That's the total capacity of the ark. But if you calculate what it would have taken to put all these animals aboard, it would have only taken 2 of 73 cars each. In other words, they conclude there was room. So it had all the room for the species. All right, we got them in there, especially if you just take in the small ones. You don't have to take in the grandmas, you know, take in the babies. So you got the small ones. All right. And how much food would be needed? You got to feed these creatures. All right. The flood lasted more than a year. This is really getting to be challenging. How could Noah store food for a year for all the animals? For one thing, animals adapt their food supply to their needs. When they have no physical exercise, they cut down promptly on the amount of food they consume. It is also possible. I heard this suggestion many years ago, and I think it solves the problem. It is also possible that the animals hibernated while on the ark. They didn't have to eat. God put them to sleep. Now, you think that's impossible. Look, all the miracles in the Bible are solved in the first verse of the first book. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. If that verse is true, then you shouldn't have a problem with any other miracle or supernatural thing in all of the Bible. So could God put all the animals to sleep for a year? Of course he could. The animals could have survived in confined quarters with little or no food or better bodily exercise. If that were the case, perhaps the food Noah stored was one great meal when they entered the ark and one good meal when they left the ark. Welcome aboard, have dinner. Go to sleep, wake up, have a meal, you're on your own. Interesting concept. Next question. Is there any evidence that remains that the ark still exists? How many of you have ever seen a documentary on the possibility that the ark is still there? Ah, of all the things I've talked about, this is the one that most people know about that are Christians. According to Genesis, the ark came to rest on Mount Ararat, Genesis 8:4. Mount Ararat is located in eastern Turkey and has two summits. One is 16,984 feet high, and the other is 12,806 feet high. Climbing the mountain is exceedingly difficult. The higher summit is permanently covered with glacial ice and snow beginning at 13,000 feet. The ice is very hard, slippery, and steep. From the main glacier, there extends 12 finger glaciers containing 100-foot crevices. Climbers have been known to set off an avalanche by simply talking to each other. Winds blow at more than 100 miles an hour. Most of the year, it is also covered with clouds that obscure visibility. During the past 200 years, many have perished attempting to reach the ark. A major hindrance to the expedition is the Kurds. You've heard of the Kurds? If you watch the news at all, the Kurds are in Iraq, and they've been involved in the war with Syria. That's who we're talking about. the Kurds, the local residents of the villages around Ararat. Most expeditions must depend on them to be their guides and porters. But because they fear that the summit is a place of destruction, those guides are usually unreliable. They often refuse to go beyond the lower snow level. They have been known to desert the expedition in the middle of the night. Two men have done extensive research on Noah's Ark, and they say the research indicates that since 1856, 200 people in 23 separate sightings have seen Noah's Ark on Mount Ararat. Let me pursue this further. They've been recorded during these sightings during ancient, medieval, and modern times. Reports of people visiting the ark date back to 700 BC. One Babylonian historian who lived around 300 BC said the remains of the ark could still be seen. That's 300 years before Christ, folks. In the Antiquity of the Jews, Josephus, the Jewish historian that lived in the first century, said, quote, they show relics of the ark even to this day. In 180 AD, a man wrote, quote, and the ark, the remains to this day, can be seen on the Arabian mountains. The only coin to bear a biblical scene is one depicting Noah's ark. The coin pictures the ark as a box with an open lid floating on the water, while the lid shelters Noah and his wife from the rain. On the side of the ark is inscribed Noah in Greek. Above the ark is a dove with an olive spray in its beak. It also contains the inscription of the people of that land. The other side of the coin has a Roman emperor, and so it was struck around 300 AD in modern Turkey. A couple of years later, a man wrote one of the first encyclopedias, and one of the most learned men of his day said, quote, even to this day, wood remains of it and can be seen there, meaning Ararat. Then an Armenian prince became a monk and said he saw the ark in 1254. The book called The Travelers and the explorer Marco Polo said, quote, the ark of Noah still rests on the top of a certain great mountain where the snow stays so long that no one can climb it. In June of 1670, a man, a Dutch adventurer, met a monk in the Ararat region and gave him a small wooden cross that he said was taken from Noah's Ark. The Dutchman requested a written testimony from the monk. In it, the monk said, quote, I myself entered the Ark with my own hands, cut from the wood of one of the compartments the fragments from which the cross is made. End of quote. That is dated July 22nd, 1670, and it's signed by the monk. Beyond these sightings, recorded throughout history, major expeditions of Ararat began in the 19th century. In 1829, Dr. Frederick Perrin conducted the first historically recorded expedition. He ascended to the summit, but apparently did not see the ark. He did conclude that unlike most of the mountains of the world, Ararat has a level plateau between its summits, large enough to hold the vessel the size of the ark as described in Genesis. In fact, he said, it would only have occupied a tenth of the surface of that plateau. Remember I told you it had two plateaus? One was about, 16,000, one was 12,000? He says there's a plateau between them, and it's large enough to hold the ark. During the 1800s, another expedition followed. Some reached the summit, and others failing to complete the trip to the top. Some saw the ark, some did not, because it was covered with snow. On September 12, 1876, at the 13,000-foot level of Mount Ararat, one British statesman, jurist, and author found a piece of wood 4 feet long and 5 inches thick, evidently cut by some tool so far above the tree line that it would not have been possible for it to be a natural fragment. He brought it back to London, and the newspapers hailed it at the time that they had found the ark, but scholars of the day scoffed at that idea. The first official comment by the Turkish government was made in August 1883, when they announced the discovery of Noah's Ark. The story was repeated in leading American newspapers. For example, on August the 10th, 1883, an article appeared in the Chicago Tribune, which said, and I quote, "A paper at Constantinople announces the discovery of Noah's Ark. It appears that some Turkish commissioners appointed to investigate the question of an avalanche on Mount Ararat suddenly came upon a gigantic structure of very dark wood protruding from a glacier. The article went on to say that men entered the ark and the interior was divided into partitions 15 feet high. They could not get into three of the rooms because the others were filled, they could only get into three of the rooms because the others were filled with ice. Because of the treatment the reporters received in the newspaper and by scientists, the government did not conduct another experiment." There was a prince from India said on April the 25th, 1887, he found the ark weighed in the rocks and half filled with snow and ice, and that it was made of dark beams of very thick wood. Around the turn of the 20th century, there was a man who said when he was a boy, his uncle took him to see Noah's Ark. In 1970, he told researchers his story. According to this story, his uncle helped him climb on top of the ark, and this little boy looked after sheep in the nearby slopes, not only walked on top of the ark, he looked inside through a hole on the top of the ark. All he could see was darkness. In 1916, a Russian pilot stationed about 25 miles northeast of Mount Ararat saw the ark from his plane. He reported that to his captain, who sent the information to the Russian government. The Tsar sent soldiers to investigate. They found the ark, measured it, and even took pictures. A few days after the Tsar received the report, the Bolshevik overthrew the Russian government. Years later, there was a colonel in the Tsar's White Russian Army who wrote a detailed article on this story. He gave names, dates, and places. The article appeared in a Russian newspaper in November 1945. Other reporters talked to the soldiers about their experience with the ark. There have been reports since World War II. Planes have sighted it, but there's been no hard evidence like a photo that has survived. The experience of a French explorer, however, was different. He conducted 4 expeditions on Mount Ararat in search of the ark, 1952, 1953, 1955, and 1969. On August 17, 1952, he saw a patch of blackness in the ice, but lacked the necessary equipment to go down to the site. In July 1953, he got closer, but again came back empty-handed without a fragment or a photograph. When he returned to the site in 1955, he discovered at least one-third of the ice had been thawed. The object was still buried in the ice, but this time, he and his 11-year-old son were able to cut off a piece of wood. On July 6, 1955, this man and his son retrieved the piece of wood about 5 feet long from Mount Ararat. They found it slightly less than 13,000 feet. Based on an earlier sighting of the intact art, it had been thought to be about 14,000 feet. Many have concluded that the ark broke during an earthquake. However, the main part is resting above 14,000 feet, and a smaller part are shattered below. On July 31st, 1969, a search team returned again to the site, and this town found 5 pieces of wood, the longest being nearly 17 inches. The wood samples were hand cut and squared with pitch. Tests indicated that the wood was a variety of white oak. He had the wood tested with the same method used to date ancient artifacts, including King Tut's coffin. They did some research, and it says one can suppose the age of the wood sample giving was around 5,000 years old. That was the Center of Forestry Research and Analysis in Paris, said the wood was 4,500 years old. Carbon-14 tests conducted at Cambridge, Massachusetts, the University of Pennsylvania, and the University of California concluded that the wood dates between 1250 and 1700 years old. But after A.B. Libby conducted radiocarbon dating, Dr. Melvin A. Cook, the 1968 Nobel Gold Medal winner, proved major discrepancies in the method. Dr. Cook specifically said that the assumptions on which carbon-14 are based are not applicable to these samples because the carbon-14 ion exchange in freshwater lakes are different. So, the point is that some have dated it 5,000 years old, some dated these samples 4,005 years old, and some said carbon dating mentioned only 1,250 years old, but that has been disputed. Because Ararat is a restricted military zone on the Russian-Turkish border, the Turkish government has refused to grant permits for airplanes to fly over the area. There are rumors that spy planes have photographed the Ark, but the military is not willing to release them, possibly because Ararat is in a military zone, making any photographs of the area classified. A Russian missile fuel depot and landing pad are located less than 40 miles from Mount Ararat. In 1974, the fellow that was from Hollywood made an illegal expedition up Mount Ararat, perhaps because that of the published incident in April 1974. The Turkish government, when they found out he did this illegally, banned travel by foreigners on Ararat. There are a number of possible reasons for such an action, including, number one, a fear of possible CIA involvement in an expedition. Two, fear of the possible foreign involvement with the Kurds who live in the vicinity. Three, fear of smuggling ancient treasures out of the country. Also, opium growers use the road at the base of Mount Ararat. It is a major drug smuggling route, and their half-hearted efforts at controlling opium smuggling, the Turks want to keep the foreigners out of the area. Another factor is the Muslim tradition, and Turkey is all Muslim. I was there a number of years ago, and I think I was told There were 30 million people in the country and 30 Christians. Those figures might be accurate, but they're close. At any rate, there's a Muslim tradition that the ark landed on another mountain in Turkey, and that's another reason they won't let you go anywhere near it. So, is there evidence that the ark's still up there? There are reports, and I went through all this to demonstrate, they go all the way back to ancient times, through the Middle Ages, into modern times, and that, because of the political situation, it's impossible for anybody to get up there in a legitimate exposition today. However, it may be circumstantial, but given all the other stuff concerning the flood, I think there's a possibility that that ark is still at Mount Ararat. And I think it would be just fantastic if the Lord would let somebody find it. Would that make, it wouldn't do any good. They'll explain it away. They'll figure out some way to explain it away. But I think there's enough circumstantial evidence to indicate that the ark is up there. Now, I want to conclude by making an application or two. Did you know that the New Testament makes an application of the ark? Do you know that? I'm not going to take the time to go through all this, but in 1 Peter chapter 3, it talks about the ark. And it says that there was an ark, 8 souls were saved through water. It's an antitype that now saves us. And it says baptism. And some people jump on this passage and say, aha, baptism saves us. No, the baptism he's talking about in the flood, they didn't get wet. They got on the ark. And I don't have time to go through this passage, but it's talking about spiritual baptism and the fact that when we trust Christ, we are placed in Christ, and that's our salvation. And the illustration is the ark. Those who were in the ark got saved from the flood. So the ark, according to Peter, is an example. It's an illustration of the fact that the Lord saves us. All right. Now, this is pretty heady stuff, and I really prefer to be practical. I don't mind being heady, but I like to give some practical application. And so I had to scratch, but I found some practical application to the ark. You ready for this? Everything I needed to know, I learned from Noah's ark. Here are the 11 lessons, and with this, I leave you. 1, don't miss the boat. 2, remember that we all are in the same boat. 3, plan ahead. It wasn't raining when Noah built the ark. 4, stay fit. When you're 80 years old, someone may ask you to do something really big. 5, don't listen to the critics. Just get on with the job that needs to be done. 6, build your future on high ground. 7, for safety's sake, travel in pairs. 8, speed isn't always an advantage. Snails were on board with the leopards. 9, when you're stressed, float a while. 10, this is my favorite. Remember, the ark was built by amateurs, the Titanic was built by professionals. 11, no matter the storm, there's always a rainbow waiting at the end. Amen. Father,